You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
The New Testament book of Revelation is light on scenes of battle, but never hesitates to announce that God has won a battle. Whether the text implies that a battle never actually happened, or just moves to the battle so far out of the narrative zone of attention that they're rendered unimportant, whichever it is, Revelation as a narrative never says that God wins battles so that the disciples... Whoops. And let me start that over, because I actually typed that wrong. All right, Britt, sorry about that. It actually does say that God won battles so that... Okay, let me try that again. The New Testament book of Revelation is light on scenes of battle, but never hesitates to announce that God has won a battle. Whether the text implies that a battle never actually happened, or just moves the battles so far out of the narrative zone of attention that they're rendered unimportant, Revelation as a narrative tells us that God has won these battles so that the disciples of Jesus don't live as killers. But you know, we're not really living in a moment of open persecution anymore. And David Zall's book, The Big Relief, The Urgency of Grace for a Worn-Out World, brings a version of that same good news to 21st century folk who don't face that kind of Book of Revelation persecution. Instead, David speaks to scenes of exhaustion, exploring some of the fake news that tries to do the work of grace and showing why only grace really saves. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome David to the show to talk about fake grace and the real stuff. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Nathan. Glad to be here.
The big claim of this book seems to be that in our moment, for a certain kind of reader, the theological reality called grace cashes out in relief, as the title says. Before we dig into particular chapters, tell us about the scope of that term relief. Does it include the relief that one gets when a tumor is benign, the relief that comes when someone shows up to help with a difficult labor? Does it have something to do with relief pitchers? Does it have to do with other things? What is relief in this book?
Well, I like how you distill it down there. It does a lot of work. It does a lot of heavy lifting, as they say. The word relief, I like it because I think it does have a immediate affective connotation that's positive, that people are looking for relief. And sometimes that is financial relief, you know, like a relief payment. And sometimes that is relief from a long day's work, relief from, you know, the headlines, relief from social media. And I like the double entendre of it also being sort of something that exists in relief. The grace of God exists basically in relief or in contrast to the many different narratives that kind of compete for our attention. So I thought it was a good way in. I think people are predominantly emotional creatures. And so I found that I kept hearing this word used by people, referencing almost every good thing in their life as a form of relief, and thought, well, in to what extent does the theological reality of grace provide tangible relief to folks? It certainly, there's something appealing about it. Relief from condemnation, relief from guilt, relief from shame, relief from death. So there's all sorts of ways in which I thought it could be an entry point into talking about grace in an expansive way that didn't reduce it down to one specific dimension.
That sounds good. Now, the book's opening chapter engages with a theologian called John Barclay and his book about grace in Paul's letters. You don't have to summarize, you know, Barclay's entire argument here by any means, but we are a nerdy bunch here at Christian Humanist Profile, so get as technical as you like. Is Barclay mainly working in a historical linguistic register? Is he working as a rhetorical scholar? Is he being a patristics guy? In what way does Barclay engage with Paul?
Well, I think he's mainly just a New Testament scholar. I wouldn't think that he's would consider himself a patristics person. I thought that he's what I was interested in was his linguistic study of the Pauline epistles as it relates to how grace is a euphemism for gift, and the way in which Paul understood grace. And so he has these, I refer to, he has a perfections of grace, they're called, sort of the various elements of grace. And he has six, I think, possibly seven. I focus in on three of them. It's not meant to be a translation of Barclay, because Barclay's, that's a doorstop of a book. It's a great book. It's worth everyone reading it who's got it. But I wanted to focus on, I thought he was very useful and to me, very instructive, giving it that scriptural foundation that I was looking for and that spoke to me personally. I'm always looking for interesting typologies and fresh ways into these old words. And he, by talking about incongruity, that's a word that I've heard elsewhere, but he really, he brought it to life for me in a way that I felt preached, and kind of gave me, and the priority of grace, the superabundance of grace. These are wonderful words that he draws out. But I didn't want to, again, there are probably places where my understanding of grace and Barclay's understanding of grace diverge a little bit, but he's certainly, he's an extremely well-respected scholar, and that's a fantastic book if people haven't read it.
Very good. Well, another figure that you engage with in that opening chapter is Robert Capon. And the phrase of his that, you know, drew my eye was, quote, affront to the deserving, unquote. Talk to our listeners a little bit about what's going on and why it is good to affront the deserving.
Well, Robert Capon is another person who had he's an Anglican or Episcopalian theologian from, he died about 15 years ago, not that long ago. And he was a fiction writer as well, and as well as a food critic for the New York Times. Very, very interesting thinker and an extremely vivid writer with a big gift for sort of translating the parables or whatever, any kind of New Testament material into fresh contemporary language. So he has this famous book called Between Noon and Three, which was the book that he was most proud of, that was the hardest one for him to get published because it's a very radical book about grace as it relates to, in that case, it's a adultery, and it's visceral stuff. You can understand why some people didn't want to publish this book. Anyway, he has this prayer in it about restore to us, preacher, the kind of just desserts. Like I can't paraphrase it right off the top of my head, but he thinks of grace is something that we hate because it actually upends the hierarchies of deserving that we spend our days propping up, that give us a sense of control and predictability and make life worth manageable. But he has got a very, whatever you do, preacher, do not preach to us grace. Allow us to have one card of our own that we can play that in order to warrant divine favor or whatever it is, however he puts it. I've used that prayer of a, referenced it many times, and a lot of what this book is doing is trying to cherry pick or compile, curate all of my the favorite, most pastoral and maybe rhetorically effective descriptions and pictures of grace, and sort of put them all into one place. And you can't do that without Robert Capon, because no one was more pithy than he.
Right, right. I don't know why the phrase is coming to mind, but the possibly my favorite line from Flannery O'Connor from the short story Revelation, "I am not a warthog from hell," seems like the objection to grace.
Yes, yes, I love that. And this is a person. She was always. What did she say that grace often has a violent character to it for people whose human beings whose heads are so hard that the only way they can experience grace is through some form of violence. And that's quite a statement to make, but it animates all of her stories. So she understood this stuff. It's a relief that people resist. In other words, it's an affront to what we think we deserve, as Capon would say. And of course, when you when you've lost, when you've got egg on the face, or when you've fallen on your face, and you feel like you deserve nothing, that's when grace becomes so operative and alive and of life and death importance. But until that moment, oftentimes it seems like an indulgence or something irresponsible given to those who, again, deserve anything but.
Well, now that we've talked a little bit about that opening chapter, I want to pause and ask a question about audience. As I made my way through your book and enjoyed reading your book, the sense that I got is that this is something like a devotional, but it is pitched towards readers who don't normally read devotionals. Have I missed your project entirely, or are you aiming your book at something like that readership?
Yes, I'm always trying to write with a non-churchy audience in mind. I think that the people that read it tend to be church-going Christians of one stripe or another, but it is what I'm always hoping for is to provide things that they can give for Christmas to their kind of their fallen or, you know, but lapsed or curious relatives, that would be something that they could confidently give and say, this has some substance, this has some it's got some humor, but it also might give you some insight as to why someone would want to be a Christian as much as sort of just hammer you over the head with assertions. So I'm trying. It's an almost evangelistic or pre-evangelistic project I'm always engaged in. But I find that, you know, the truth is, a lot of us are need that, our basic confidence restored continually. And that's what this book is trying to do. So I don't see myself as like some kind of and I do a lot of preaching in our immediate context here. So I have had the benefit of seeing what kind of illustrations and what sorts of formulations have a way of puncturing contemporary defenses firsthand, and then saying, okay, well, something about this seems to be able to move people into a different register, and I'll some of this other stuff isn't going to work. But I'm also my books, Nathan, I'm always trying to provide a variety of entry points. So there is something pop cultural. There's going to be something personal. There's going to be hopefully some serious intellectual content. There's going to be some scriptural stuff. There's going to be maybe just some personal anecdote. I want to do what I can to I guess have a shotgun, or if certain, and that applies to the whole book too. So if one of these avenues of grace is of disinterest, active disinterest to someone, it's like, I don't deal with status anxiety. Well, that's amazing. You are a sanctified individual. However, maybe you're deeply afraid of death, or maybe you are absolutely full of guilt, and you. Here's how the grace of God addresses the guilty conscience, but here's how it addresses the status, the person who's anxious about whether or not they're worthy of love. So,
sounds good. Now, chapter 2 struck me as reflecting an important spiritual discipline, namely learning to imagine and to sing forgiveness as extending beyond what you call mitigation. So when you talk about mitigation, what recognizably Disney movie reality are you naming, and how does forgiveness stand distinct from mitigation?
Most of the ways, when I mean mitigation, I mean that when someone has wronged you, the most immediate, certainly the most popular way of trying to let them off the hook these days is to find some mitigating factor. Well, you know, like this is how they were raised, or this is their current, you know, mental health makeup, and so they really didn't mean it. It wasn't as bad as a thing as you might think, or if you only knew what it was like to live in their shoes. And all those things are important. It's not like they're not important. However, forgiveness, it's more than just shrinking an infraction down to sort of a more manageable size through understanding someone's background or circumstances. Forgiveness says, even when you have actually done something premeditated, maliciously, self-oriented in a kind of a damaging way, forgiveness extends to that. And so you almost, the forgiveness like maximizes the infraction, if anything. And mitigation tries to shrink it so that there's nothing to be forgiven. It's really just, you just need to understand or empathize. Forgiveness says, well, actually, I've been truly hurt by someone who, whether they meant to or not, has done serious damage to myself or to my community or to God. And there, it requires more than a rhetorical or even sort of psychological unpacking. So that's, it's hard to do that without sounding callous. Like, I do believe that mitigation could be helpful. You know, I do want to know what motivated a person to do something so mean or so unkind. But when there isn't something, when it was just simply the dark side of human nature, our sin just simply asserting itself, running wild in a way that we had no control over, the hope of grace is that there is a way forward even then. And so that's the radical aspect that people get very uncomfortable with.
And that's one of those things that, I mean, you know, I pointed to Disney movies in particular, because I feel like, you know, at least for the last 10 years, every Disney movie bad guy, you find out eventually that, you know, well, someone hurt them before, and that's, you know, what makes them so mean. And I think, you know, that I feel like we've lost something, you know, since the days of Maleficent, the animated Maleficent, I should say, because of course now there's a traumatized Maleficent, but you know, that really is just that mean.
Yeah. That stepmother in that first Cinderella scared me to death, because she was just so mean, and there was no reason for it. She just was, and we've all known people who have a malicious bent, or some other kind of bent. So we have to, I don't think grace makes much sense in the absence of any wrongdoing, or, I've come to just describe it as like there is a dark side to human nature. It's not all, everyone's doing the best they can with what they've got. There's, in some sense, we are taking the path of least resistance, and, there are some very malignant, forces at work, and to acknowledge that is not some kind of dreary, defeated pessimism. I think it allows actually for the grace of God to bloom that much brighter, because it means that it can shine even in those moments. Even the evil stepmother from Cinderella, in the kingdom of God, like there's. What is there mercy for her? You know, that's the question. Not mercy after she explains that she too is the daughter of a terrible stepmother, and therefore really shouldn't. You know, tell that to this 2-year-old who had to bear the brunt of her awfulness. So,
yes, indeed, yes, indeed. Now, I know I've heard Jason Michelli tell the story of Jim Nestigen and the Vietnam vet, but not everyone who listens to this show listens to Crackers and Grape Juice, so. Take a moment and let our listeners know, I mean, some of the broad brushstrokes of that story. Leave them some reason to read your book, of course, but what goes on with this Vietnam vet, and I mean, what makes it a good parable for this forgiveness beyond mitigation?
Yeah, it's about Nestigan's a very funny, you know, jovial storyteller. I knew him a little bit myself, but Jason was the one I heard the story from. But then I've gotten to know some of his students who knew this story well, and he's on a transatlantic flight with a man who finds out that he's a pastor, and he starts pouring out his soul, especially about all of these terrible things that he did in Vietnam as a soldier and that he hasn't really been able to get over in his life, but constantly saying, but I don't believe in all that God stuff, you know, and don't preach to me, preacher. And Jim just sort of sits there and listens. And the guy keeps going on the whole time. And at the end of the flight, says Jim sort of turns to him and says, do you have anything else you want to confess, you know, that you want to throw in there? And he said, what? I haven't been confessing. He's like, yes, you have this whole flight long. And as a preacher of the gospel, I have an obligation. When I've heard a confession, I need to declare the full forgiveness of all of your sins through the blood of Jesus Christ. And he gets up in the middle of the plane and does it. You'll have to find out what happened, because there's an amazing sort of PS epilogue to this story. But he does upset the flight attendants at the time, and he something very beautiful and holy happens in this moment of absolution on this air, this flight, that I thought, spelled out what's at stake here and how this guy didn't even know to ask what he was asking, but his soul sort of did. And he wasn't explaining it away. I just did what I was told. Or Jim didn't say to him, "You were just following orders. You got nothing to feel badly about." No, he said, "You know, keep anything else you got to say." And then, like, he doesn't shrink the infraction. He places it at the foot of the cross or on the shoulders of the suffering servant, and declares on behalf of Christ this sort of full absolution. This man is just absolutely falls apart. And they're really, anyway, you have to read the rest of it, but it's a beautiful story.
Good.
True story.
Leave people reason to get the book. That's what we're after here. Now, if mitigation is one side of the false grace coin, I think that the other side of that coin in this book is the 21st century use of the adjective toxic as a descriptor for one's enemies. You point this up as a particular challenge to Christians, and especially Christian teaching on forgiveness. So what particular difficulties arise from calling one's enemies toxic?
Well, no one ever describes themselves as toxic is the real problem. I understand when we talk about a toxic workplace, we all know what that is. Like, it's you've worked in situations that are easier to work in than other ones. And oftentimes a toxic workplace is one where there's a micromanaging or megalomaniac of a boss who has created a culture of fear and threat and paranoia. And that's real. Like, that's a lot of people work in those. I hate to say it, but it's true. And it's true in the church. I'm sure it's true in schools, Nathan. But it is a way to, it makes, it becomes a purification thing. Like, you know, this person is, their very presence is toxifying my life, and that they are the problem, and I need to just simply excise them from the situation and restore balance or, you know, cleanliness. There is like a purity aspect that feels pretty religious to it. So like your very presence sullies a situation morally, and it compromises me by having you even on campus or whatever. This was a little more active a few years ago, I think. But so again, it just allows us to place the blame at these a few personalities out there that are poisonous, rather than understanding that we all share in the inheritance of Adam, and there's a the point to in life is not to get rid of all toxic influences, because at the end you end up needing to get rid of yourself. You become a church of if you become a church of one, you really become a church of zero. So it's toxicity is not something that can ultimately be ever fully expunged through effort. It's more a matter of forgiven, to be shown grace, whatever mechanism it looks like. I find it's a way to talk about an enemy without talking about an enemy. Like, this is my ex-BFF, or that's a toxic person. I just need to cut out this person. There's a lot of this estrangement stuff that goes on today. And the idea is always that all the problem in this relationship is external to me. And, the grace of God just goes further than that. I mean, I know that there are certain situations in which people need to draw a boundary, but heaven forbid you're the person who someone's drawing a boundary against. Grace has to extend. When we hear "love your enemies," it's like this is how God treats us. He loves the toxic. He spent time with the toxic. You might even say he became toxic for the sake of to redeem, to purify those who were poisoned or something like that. I don't want to take the metaphor too far, but it's just another contemporary way of talking about these age-old dynamics that I thought was important to surface.
That makes a lot of good sense. And you know, one of the things that you mentioned kind of in passing there is really what concerns me most about the use of toxic in those kinds of exchanges. And that is that inside of that metaphor, there's almost no hope held out for reconciliation. And, you know, I always want to, you know, leave space for, all right, you know, there will be a time, you know, when for the sake of safety, for the sake of other kinds of concerns, some kind of separation has to be in place. But to call them toxic makes them inherently beyond the reach of any kind of future reconciliation. It seems like that's just such a bleak future to hold out for another human being.
Yeah, I don't think a Christian is really allowed to grab the hold of that. I don't think anyone's irredeemable, at least beyond the reach of God. They might be beyond your reach, and you might be able to say, listen, God's got to deal with you. I can't, or this, I can't forgive, but I can trust that there's a God who might forgive you and me for my own lack of ability to forgive, et cetera, et cetera. But to say that there is, we don't do hopeless as Christians. I don't think that that's really something you can, at least on Christian grounds, I don't think you can consign someone as a, you who are not God can consign someone to the pit of hell without, you just don't have that authority.
Grace is not a technique. That seems straightforward, but you dedicate an entire chapter to that proposition. So why would we do well to enlist Jacques Ellul to think our way through grace is not a technique?
Well, Ellul's an interesting thinker. French, I guess, anarchist is what people always say about him. That seems a little, maybe that's true. He was very interested. He has this book called The Technological Society, where he talks about everything, the principle that guides all of our all of modernity is sort of the distilling all things into technique, which means distilling things down into kind of efficiency. And I do this in order to get that, and the point of life is to make things ever more efficient. And that leaves kind of no room for not only love, grace, humanity, but it backfires. And so there is no technique. We think the way to solve our problems and the world's problems is through to come up with better and faster strategies, and yet and to use technology to do this. And the cruel irony of modernity is that we find that the more of these things we employ, the more complicated life gets. It gets faster, but it also gets more stressful. And at no point do we achieve these ends that we are promised through technique. So I think that that was to me a helpful way of just talking about the productivity mandate that a lot of us live under, that the point of life is to always be producing, to be, and that is one area in which I know a lot of folks who maybe don't struggle with some sense of deep moral guilt that they've offended a holy God, but they do feel like that they are not, they are less than if they're not constantly producing more and more and more, and that the point of life is to improve according to a very narrow set of metrics. And so grace in that respect usually looks like some form of rest, some kind of lack of productivity. It looks like play. It looks like, the permission to not produce. And that is a radical proposition in a world that is sort of trying to squeeze people always to getting more done, and to never allow children to have extracurriculars that don't add some sort of tangible benefit to their resume. So I thought it was an interesting way, the way of talking about the law, as it bears down on folks in very real ways.
I wonder, and this is not something that I wrote into the notes, but it, hearing you just now, it makes me wonder whether the TikTok addiction, and I'm using TikTok here as a metonym for all kinds of time-wasting electronic diversions. And I've forgotten the name of the psychological principle, but the principle goes something along the lines of a perfectionist who catches himself falling short of perfection will just throw it all away and just say, just forget it all. I wonder if that dynamic, I mean, accounts in some ways for the TikTok, YouTube addiction, where people will, you know, as you say, you know, feel terribly guilty about, you know, being unproductive, and then they'll doom scroll for 6 hours.
I think that's 100% true. I always remember thinking that, like, you'd read about procrastinators being, they're not actually lazy. They're perfectionists. So they won't, they think it's something that isn't worth doing if it's not worth doing in the best possible way. And so once you miss that window, you just say to hell with it, and you just do kind of, you sit in the slop, as it were. And I think that that's a increasingly a place that a lot of us do live, and that we're consumed by this stuff that we think we're consuming. And you wake up, you don't even know who you are, and it we think, oh, it's because people don't have any kind of aspirations. It's like, no, their aspirations are actually too high. Like, is the problem? The expectations are too lofty. Because if they were a little more humble, if you had a slightly lower anthropology, as it were, you could sort of say, oh, well, I can at least do something today. Like, I can, it's not all shot, but instead you just sort of think, well, I'm just gonna ride this for the rest of the day, and then ruin my next day too. But it's a very strange world we're living in right now, Nathan, when it comes to TikTok addiction.
Yes, indeed. Well, David, before I read this book, I don't think that combining conversations about the moral certainty rhetoric that's arisen on social media with competing atonement theories would have occurred to me, but it made a good deal of sense when you did it. So give us a taste, but once again, leave our listeners some reasons to go out and get your book. That's, you know, what we want to do here. So what do 90s era irony, Obama era online moral certainty, and substitutionary atonement have to do with each other?
That was the hardest chapter, right, Nathan? The chapter about guilt and atonement. I wanted to spell out to me, atonement usually addresses guilt. And one of the ways that contemporary theologians have sometimes, or philosophers have sometimes, denigrated atonement is by saying, oh, you got nothing to feel guilty about. And that's a nice fiction, because which has nothing to do with reality, because people feel guilty whether you tell them to or not. And I just kept, you read over and over again these advice columns of people, young people writing in, who just feel terribly guilty. They don't even know why they feel guilty, but they just know that they feel guilty, and that seems to be their operating paradigm, even though they don't have any kind of larger moral scheme that they would consciously subscribe to. And so I, one of the, how do you get into guilt in a contemporary setting? And I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the moral certainties of today that are so ironclad, and that the current generation, at least, is very far removed from the laissez-faire, hey, nothing matters kind of world that I grew up in the grunge era of, like, the 1990s, which I'm talking about, the quote-unquote moral relativism that was, we heard our parents say, oh, we're so afraid of moral relativism because, you know, Kurt Cobain says that there's no such thing as right and wrong. And today, that has been so, whatever you think of it, whatever you think of sort of everything is irony, Stephen Malkmus world that I grew up in, today the what we thought was going to happen was that there was going to be no such thing as right and wrong, and it has not been turned out to be the case. In fact, we were living, at least for a little while, and probably still are, in a world in which everything was wrong. like there was a very narrow path that was of acceptability in a kind of a, I'm talking more about a, in a progressive context, generally, though there's a version of this on the right too. But all of a sudden, it became very tight, and a huge amount of moral condemnation just hopping on top of people, and the kind of narcissism of small differences and purity spirals you find in like contemporary veganism or political extremism. And so I thought to myself, well, how does Christianity deal with guilt? If we are, let's take back for a second, like what the law is condemning us for, because it was condemning us from something very different in the 90s than it is for today in the 2025. But what do we say? And we say that that guilt, you can try to shift it. You can try to blame shift and kind of heap your guilt onto someone else. You can do all sorts of kind of acrobatics to distance yourself from, to deflect and to distance yourself from guilt. But the Christian understanding it is that it's some way that God has atoned for, has made atonement for your guilt. Today, I think it's much more common that your entire life, if you grew up and you see these people who grew up very wealthy and they feel terrible about it, and then the rest of their life is trying to atone for what their slaveholding ancestors or something like that. And there's something noble about it. I don't want to say it's all bad, but it has no end. You know, it can be a form of slavery that I think is anti-human, anti-flourishing. So we're just really as a way into talking about substitutionary atonement, which I think is not a terrible thing. I could see it's very ripe for misuse and has been weaponized in all sorts of different ways. But if you've ever done something truly wrong, and I cite this guy, Richard Beckin there, who was one of my favorite sort of contemporary theologians, was talking about having, he had, used to have a very, very skeptical of kind of a quote-unquote atonement, any kind of atonement theory, whether that be Christus Victor, whether that be, liberation theology, whether that be some kind of penal understanding. He didn't want to talk about it. And then he went and started doing Bible studies in maximum security prisons. And all of a sudden, the guys only wanted to talk about that. They're like, wait a second. People who had been convicted, you know, of terrible, terrible crimes, they were all of a sudden very interested in hearing about substitution. And they were interested in hearing about, or at least propitiation. These antiquated words were, he was like, well, maybe it could be that our aversion to atonement is just an aversion to guilt that's afforded by privilege. And it's much easier to to thumb your nose at atonement when you've never really done anything wrong, or at least never been exposed for doing anything wrong. So that's how my mind worked to get there, trying to find a way to sort of, what are the ways in which people do feel guilty? They don't feel guilty. We often don't feel guilty about the things we should feel guilty about. But we do feel guilty about a lot of things we shouldn't feel guilty about. And so wherever your guilt is, if you're a person in America in the 21st century, you're familiar with guilt. What do you do with it? The Christians say that there is a place to go, and that place is the foot of the cross.
And it's interesting because as the sort of what I call the sex, drugs, and rock and roll sins, became, pretty exclusively associated with substitutionary atonement, I think that's where the big rejection of that way of talking about atonement, it fell on hard times. But now I think you're right that, there's an entirely new dynamic where, there are people who are genuinely scandalized by forgiveness if forgiveness is extended to white supremacists or to, the sinners of our moment rather than the sinners of 1971.
True. And I'm trying to... Anyway, I've been very gratified that chapter has not met with a bunch of flack. I mean, not to say that everyone in the world is talking about this book, but I've had some reviews of it and in some places where I thought would have real aversion to that chapter in particular, that have said this is actually a really helpful way into talking about this stuff, that maybe we've lost something. When we lose the atonement, we lose the ability to speak to guilty people. And a Christianity that has nothing to say to guilty people is not a Christianity that I'm that interested in, frankly.
Right. And, you know, in my limited experience, and it's been more conversational than, you know, in publication, people, I mean, genuinely do feel exhausted by, you know, what I call the new Victorianism. And, of course, the people who hold to it don't like it when I call it the new Victorianism, but that's kind of what it is. And, you know, the people who are the enforcers of it think that it's awful that you would offer forgiveness. But, you know, the way I figure it, probably the old Victorians felt the same way.
I think you're right, Nathan. I do. And people have hated forgiveness in every era. It just takes on a slightly different shade. I mean, it's funny. If you pay attention to the discourse online, they just don't want certain people forgiven.
That's a good way to put
it. People on the right feel that way, and people on the left feel that way. It's just like, we love forgiveness, unless it applies to those people over there.
Yes, indeed. Or if someone implies that we're the ones that need forgiving. But,
oh yeah.
And you know, of course, I already made my first allusion to Flannery O'Connor. I think that's what I like the most about Flannery O'Connor, despite the many reasons to be uncomfortable with Flannery O'Connor, which I do acknowledge. Listeners, if you go listen to Michael Farmer's Flannery O'Connor book interviews on this show, you'll find out why you should be uncomfortable with O'Connor too, but she still has some good stuff to say.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She pushed it.
Yes, indeed. Well, David, your seventh chapter, which is fittingly focused on rest, was enough to let me know that you were aiming this book at readers like me. My own life is a perpetual motion machine of communities that claim me as their own and want more of my time and my energy. The school where I teach wants more of my time and energy. My daughter's volleyball teams, and yes, that's plural, want more of my time and energy. My church wants more of my time and energy. The podcasting community wants more of my time and energy. I mean, you get it. You wrote this chapter. But here's the paradox I want to ask you about. I'm going to give you a little bit of time to comment on it. People still watch sports on TV, and that's something that just eats up hours that I just don't have. I stopped watching televised sports years ago just because I don't have the time. So what strikes me is that some folks have exhaustion, as you say, but others seem to be bored and lonely, unable to find anything to do with seemingly endless reserves of empty hours. So I know that you didn't write a sociology book, but what does grace look like when both sorts of people are living and worshiping together?
Gosh, well, I mean, meaning like some people need to, could use a little less rest is what you're saying. And some people need, can't seem to find any.
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Well, trying to think of how I would phrase that. I think one reason people like this is just what is occurring to me right this second. One reason people love sports is because it is a real time thing. It's happening that you can't. It's happening in actual time as opposed to something you can stream later and binge, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble with Zoom right now. Can we just pause for 1 second?
Yeah, absolutely.
I just got to get you back. I can't see you on my screen.
Oh, okay.
How did that happen?
I don't think I turned off my camera.
No, you didn't do anything wrong. How does it?
How fitting with your book?
How fitting with my book? Help window.
And I'll confess, I'm still relatively new with this software. It's not Zoom, it's Riverside, so I'm not sure how to troubleshoot it either, unfortunately.
Oh, it was on, we're in here. There we go. Okay, sorry. I hope your audio engineer can cut that out.
Yes, Britt, you're awesome. We love you. Thank you for cutting that
out. Thank you, Britt. Sorry, what I talk about in what you've just mentioned is this force of acceleration, which it seems to infect absolutely everything we do. And I, the constant demand for more and more and more of everything, and every year those demands seem to go up, and every year, you know, your daughter's, what were two teams, you're now going to be on a travel, a third team with an extra practice and another game.
Well, well, so one of them is the travel team, so I'm not going up to three. If it goes up to three, I stop writing the checks.
You're speaking my language right now. I have a real axe to grind about travel sports, but I also love my kids. I think that even the people that are lonely and bored, I don't think any of them are actually bored. I don't think that's the problem. I think the fact is that they're so distracted by constant input and accelerated stimulation that they don't even think to be bored, and that's one of the problems. But I think that we're all living under this accelerated world, and some of us are trying to keep up and some of us have given up, and that's what's happening here. The grace of God to that, to an accelerating world, it provides, I sort of talk about in terms of resonance, the Hartmut Rosa concept in that chapter, which I've found to be quite powerful. It's not just a slow down or adopt a more reasonable pace, or if you're totally lonely and unengaged, then ramp back things back up. I think that what we're looking for actually are real-time experiences of life, and sometimes people do find that in sports. I think that's what they're chasing actually when they're putting off things they should be doing in order to watch live sports. They're looking for something that's happening that's outside of themselves that is exciting and evidence that the entire world does not rely on their own efforts. So I'm after more resonance. I happen to find that in church a lot of times. I love the fact that church is slow paced. I get very suspicious of churches that are trying to pack more things in. I understand that pressure that we live under, but I don't think, spiritually speaking, it's the prescription that we're looking for. But I also don't think it's just, we just need to do slow church. I think that we, what we're after is God, a God who breaks into our lives with power and with presence and in unexpected ways that are not engineered by us, or through our own frantic activity. So there's not really a how-to outside of in that chapter, outside of saying that the form that grace takes in an accelerated world is this interruptive, disruptive presence of God, which cannot be controlled, but you know when you've experienced it, and you catch echoes of it when you experience things like an incredible concert, or a playing with a baby, or falling in love. These things which are kind of good, and that happen despite our inability to lasso them into tools.
Right, and I should say, I mean, I didn't frame that as precisely as I should have. Sports there was supposed to be a sort of metonymy for, you know, all of the things that people do that just eat up, you know, hours and hours and hours. And I always think, wow, where do those hours come from? Because I don't have them.
It's totally true. I think that when we talk about acceleration, it's careful. You have to be careful because, you know, I think you do have sociologists who follow people around, these people who say they don't have any time on their hands, and they'll actually like document their time. It turns out they do have plenty of time on their hands. They just aren't using it in a way that would make them feel restful. So there are better uses of your time. However, the demands and the way that the technology seems to work is by more, faster, is just, it's axiomatically better. Like unquestionably, this is what we're after. And, it's not, you know, it gets to a point where it's antithetical to human flourishing or certainly spiritual, serenity.
Right. Now, as the book gets into its closing chapters, I hit a chapter that made me realize why Jason Michelli loved this book so much, because you talk about, quote, replacement religions, unquote, that do something akin to the law in Martin Luther's theology. And our listeners who don't listen to Crackers and Grape Juice, first of all, go find some episodes and listen to them. They're great. And second of all, Jason Michelli remains the most Lutheran Methodist I know. David, talk for a moment about these religions that don't have much at all to do with Muhammad or Gautama or Hillel.
Sure. Well, I wrote a book about it that, from my perspective, called Seculosity, which is about the ways that kind of our religious feelings and devotions are harnessed by horizontal engines or targets, kind of like the way that parenting has become a religion. And it really has. It has its own cosmology. It has its own kind of morality and its own ritual and its own, certainly its own spending habits. Or the way that politics has become a religion, the way that work, career has certainly become a religion for folks, and the way that, you know, that's where you go for community now and purpose and meaning and even kind of how to make sense of eternity. You look to big corporations, and it's something I lament. I'm victim to it. The travel sports industrial complex. I think it provides parents with something to do on Sunday when they don't really know what to do, and it allows them to gives them a whole set of rituals and meaning making events. That they're usually too tired to come up with on their own, so they can outsource a lot of that stuff. I feel for those parents because I'm one of them in a lot of ways. So, but I think that what I see in most of these religions, you take like the religion of food or the religion of romance. There's a huge amount of demand, huge amount of law. You will be enough if you eat well enough, or if you date well enough, if you marry the right person, if then, that's the language of the law. If you obey, then you will be loved. And the language of grace says, because God is real, because God is good, therefore you are loved. Like it's a because therefore rather than an if then scheme. And these are very different things. And so I was really trying to talk about, and that's the chapter on play, I believe, that you're referring to. And so in this chapter, which is really looks like it's going to be the lightweight chapter, I thought it'd be clever to sneak in some of the heaviest theology of the book and to draw the distinction between the law and the gospel and the way that we look to the law for life, and it actually brings death. And the gospel, which is where God's which is God's yes, which is the forgiveness of sins and the resurrection of the dead, and that is where that is God's ultimate word to you and me, who have been crushed by all of these competing demands that we cannot fulfill, and driving ourselves crazy trying to fulfill them. So again, it's a way to, to play is usually an expression of freedom of a person who's safe and loved, and that's I'm contrasting that with work, which is always doing something in order to get some kind of measurable outcome, whether that be psychological
or to preserve an outcome that's under threat,
or to preserve an outcome that's under threat, yeah. So is my way to highlight the grace of God, but through a slightly, orthogonal means.
Back when I was a college professor, I spent a lot of time teaching Dante and Milton and Shakespeare, so I have lots of thoughts on disordered desires. You bring that pre-modern or maybe early modern category into conversation with addiction and the staggering range of addiction-like phenomena in the world. So talk to our listeners a little bit about the helpful parallels as well as the perilous false parallels. And please, for my sake, work Sloth from the Goonies into this.
Well, I just thank you for your careful attention to the book, Nathan. It's not everyone who asks me such great questions about what's actually on the page, and remind me of how much is in this short book. You know, talk about pressure. You're under pressure these days as a writer to write short books because people don't read long books. So, I think captivity is a very helpful paradigm for understanding contemporary life. I think people are ca that's what Silicon Valley has done. They've made us captive to our screens because the algorithms are so good and they just can overwhelm our better angels very, very quickly and very effectively. It's not that hard, it turns out. So, if people have a hard time understanding themselves as captives and don't want to think of themselves as captive of technology, then you just have to look to the language of addiction, which explains how captive we are to all sorts of things. There is cap you're captive to alcohol and substances. A lot of people are, and any kind of stimulants. But people are captive. You can be captive to, people pleasers are captive to what other people think about them. I know that from personal experience. And you can be captive to all sorts of your own desires, sexually or commercially, materially. People are, greed is something that holds people captive. I think anger is something that holds people captive. And so it's, I think that's a pastoral but also very biblical way of thinking about the human being as in need of sort of emancipation from the captivity, freedom for the captives. That's what Christ came to proclaim. The ultimate captivity that I see is captivity not only to sin, and the forces of evil, but I think we're captive to death and the grave. And so I, when you ask me to talk about Sloth for the Goonies, one of the images I try to pull at the end, and it was a risk because it risks trivializing something very important. But I think that for certainly guys of our generation who grew up with the Goonies, there's this moment where the Goonies at the end are about all gonna die. The cave is coming down around them after they've triggered a bunch of booby traps of One-Eyed Willy, and this character named Sloth, who's this big sort of, he's actually the enemy, but he's really the savior. He goes and he takes a rock on his back, and he becomes the doorway through which these young people are saved from certain death. And it's a beautiful picture of Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life, who does for us what we cannot do for ourselves, who frees the captives by somehow taking it on his own body. And he becomes not one doorway to pick among many, and you better not get it wrong. He becomes a doorway where you thought there's only a brick wall. And so that's why I find it to be such a powerful picture of Jesus Christ, freeing the Goonies from captivity. I try to also talk about a real life example of that from the Thailand cave stuff. It's funny the metaphors that come to you when you're writing books, because I have, I think, three things in here about diving, about underwater divers. Never in a million, I don't consider myself especially interested in underwater diving. And in fact, I had another baseball metaphor in there that my editor made me take out, and I'm not a huge baseball fan. I just, these are the things that God gives you and things that you that work in the moment.
Well, I want to talk about one more moment that seemed like it was just grooved for me, and that's your conclusion, where you talk about a deep suspicion for that category of things called felt needs. And, that was just, absolutely pointed at me because, my undergrad mentor, Phil Kennison, co-wrote an entire book about felt needs. It's something that, I think about a lot when it comes to church life. What alternatives do we have to felt needs as a driving force behind our spiritual lives? And what work do those alternatives do that felt needs don't do?
Well, it's interesting. I'd want to know what he meant by felt needs in that respect, but
Well, in his book,
there's this.
I'll go ahead and tell you real quick. I mean, the book is called Selling Out the Church. And, it is a cautionary essay that he co-wrote with a psychology professor, Jim Street, who's also, a mentor to me. And, their argument is that churches do a disservice to human beings by seeking out what they think they need instead of presenting a gospel that says that Christ is inviting us to a salvation that not only gives us what we need, but also makes us aware of what we needed, but we didn't realize we needed.
Well, I think that's beautiful. And I lived in a world for a while where there was such a deep suspicion of felt needs, though, where it became like if something addressed a felt need, it was seen as therefore unorthodox or kind of like bad. And that's I don't think that's what the critique of felt needs was. The critique
right.
of
that's the Charybdis.
Yeah, that's the Charybdis. So when church becomes a product that I'm going to scratch this itch that you have, and that's why you should come here, rather than something objective that does have subjective power to it, but is not first and foremost subjective. The problem with writing a book about relief is that you are playing into that consumerist mentality. Well, I need relief, so I'll just grab this. Maybe Christianity will provide me with relief, not because it makes me feel good rather than because it's true. But that doesn't mean that if something actually is true, in this case the gospel, there will be some affective I'd be suspicious of something that would claim to be true that had no affect, no emotional ramification whatsoever. You know, that strikes me as a very cold kettle of fish, you know. So I did want to say, it was very important to me to say, it's like Christianity is ultimately, it's relief, not because it makes you feel good, but because it's true. And this is my ultimate conviction here, is not that we've stumbled upon a nice idea that addresses us in a certain way, but it addresses us in a certain way because it's actually got truth to it. And so these things are written into the fabric of the universe. It's not to, we don't really have an influence on whether or not on how we were designed or how we were made up and what sort of appeals to us and what doesn't. And so I thought that was a really important thing to say at the end, lest it sound like I was pitching Christianity as a purely emotional thing. I believe it's the whether or not Jesus Christ rose from the dead is the principal thing. And if that's not true, then this isn't relief. So anyway, I wanted to spell that out at the end. But then also from that move into a personal story of when I saw a moment of kind of divine power and resonance that broke through anything that felt truer than true, in a way that surpassed my personal felt needs, but spoke to me beyond those almost.
Well, David, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about grace, relief, or anything else as we head for the door?
Oh, gosh. Well, if you're a Christian and your faith brings you no relief, I hope that maybe it's time to take a deeper look at grace. But if you're a person that for whom it brings only relief, maybe there's something there for you too. I'm a real believer that God does with books and with words and with preaching what God's going to do. The Holy Spirit's in charge. So I don't want to try to prescribe anything too tightly, but I really hope that the book, I mean, I always say that when I'm inscribing these books, I say, I hope this lightens the load a little bit, because I think the load of being a person in 2025, 2026, 1896, I think it's a heavy load. And I believe that we all need that the bench that is the sturdy bench that's on the cover of this book, that's a boring image for you if you're full of energy and life, but if you're a little beaten down and fatigued and don't know how you're going to really get your motor running this year, then I think that image takes on a little bit more exciting dimension. So that's what I hope for people. I want them to find relief, and it would be great if that was in any way linked to the person and work of Jesus Christ.
David Zoll, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Big Relief from Brazos Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.